Today's podcast is brought to you by Every Wednesday, a plan to inspire the people of Portland and support the place we call home. Let's get out of the house and spend some time with each other. Skip Zoom, meet for coffee, take your colleagues out to happy hour. Buying a gift? Ditch the internet and support a local maker by shopping in-store. Head into town every Wednesday and see what's going on at everywednesdaypdx.com.
Welcome to the Dive Podcast, presented by Willamette Week, where every Saturday we discuss the biggest news stories of the week with Portland's noisiest newsmakers, savviest culturistas, and some of the best journalists in the game. I'm your host, Brianna Wheeler, and I want to hear from you. So send your questions and comments to me, bwheeler@wweek.com. All right, y'all, enjoy the show.
La Mota dispensaries have been notable for more than a few unique reasons. As bulk cannabis buyers, La Mota trailblazed the buy low, sell low blueprint for bargain weed across not just the Portland metro, but all throughout Oregon. Their founder, only 20-something at the brand's inception, is a hyper-motivated, politically-minded Latina with gubernatorial aspirations. Altogether, the shop's successes and its sensational ownership have made the brand one of the most well-known in the state. But beneath the gloss of high femme minority wunderkind leadership, there were unpaid vendors, stiffed service workers, tax liens, and employees who lamented the brand's lack of security in an era where dispensaries are seeing a terrifying uptick in violent robberies. ¿Tú quieres fumar mota de la mota? Well, what are you willing to sacrifice to save a few bucks?
It's Saturday, April 1st, and this is episode 117 of The Dive. In addition to hosting this podcast, I've also been the primary contributor to the WW's Potlander column, and as such, one would think, probably should have crossed paths with La Mota founders Rosa Casares and Aaron Mitchell at least once. But I have not. No tea, no shade, no pink lemonade. I totally reached out a few times to invite Rosa to be featured in the Potlander, but was met with radio silence, despite one of my main MOs being rallying behind women of color in the industry. But whatever, I'm not tripping. It's no big deal. Especially after reading Sophie Peel's in-depth examination of the business as it navigates lawsuits, back taxes, unpaid vendors. I guess that avoidance makes sense. Well, I'll have Sophie on in one sec to discuss her reporting. But first, here's what I learned from this week's edition of Willamette Week. From the web, Lucas Manfield reports the Washington Center building has again been boarded up following last week's WW story about the fentanyl marketplace that was operating inside the vacant building. Building owners are salty AF about it. Lucas apparently found the boarding pretty ineffective. A pair of men appeared to be selling shoes inside the vacant building. And in another Lucas Manfield story update, Robert King, the convicted elderly murderer that Lucas covered in his January story, The Redemption of Robert King, has been denied parole. Consider this book closed. For now. And in Brianna news, I will be on sabbatical for the next two episodes, but I will be back in the studio on April 22nd to celebrate the 420 issue. Now, let's reconvene the Curly Blonde Caucus, aka Amy and Sophie, to discuss her cover story, Strange Budfellows.
A lot's going on with La Mota. They are, you know, within a span of 5 or 6 years, they've become the second largest dispensary chain in the state. They grew really quickly. At this point, they hold 37 retail licenses with the state. We think that 32 of them are actually operating right now, and they have dispensaries all over. They have like 8 in Portland, and then they've got a bunch sort of in Southern Oregon and in random places across the state. The company was founded by a guy named Aaron Mitchell and his partner, longtime partner named Rosa Casares. Mitchell is 45, Casares is 34, and they came from Florida around 2009, 2010, with the intent of getting into the medical cannabis world. Mm-hmm. They opened their first dispensary in Southeast Portland. And then, you know, when weed was recreationally legalized, I mean, they grew insanely fast. And they had a model of, you know, buying fairly cheap properties. I mean, as cheap as you can get them in the real estate market, but cheap properties, giving them a bit of a facelift and then filling them with product. What we found, though, is that, you know, they're definitely encountering some financial troubles. So since 2019, they've been issued over $1.6 million in tax liens from the Oregon Department of Revenue.
Whoa.
And that's including over $592,000 in state cannabis sales taxes, because the state obviously taxes retail cannabis sales. And then they've also been issued liens from the Internal Revenue Service for at least $1.4 million for both personal income tax and a type of employment tax. So, you know, that's the tax part. And then they've also been sued quite a bit in Oregon circuit courts. We found 30 lawsuits since 2017.
Whoa.
And those have been filed by a number of cannabis vendors. So who have sold them product and alleged that they just never paid them for it. That's by, you know, a couple that was doing kind of handyman work on a lot of their shops. They're alleging, you know, $47,000 of unpaid work, and even their tax company that they hired to do their taxes in 2021 is suing them, alleging that, you know, they didn't pay them 140 some thousand. They're facing a lot of troubles, and, you know, they've settled some of those lawsuits, but other ones are going to trial either this year or next year.
Mm-hmm.
So I think things are percolating.
Oh my gosh, you're getting like whiffs of the brouhaha starting around 2019. But it's 2023 now. How were they able to get away with this for this many years?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I think that's part of the puzzle that we haven't really nailed down yet. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Oregon Liquor and Cannabis Commission, that's the state agency that regulates cannabis and has since it was, you know, legalized. You know, they say that they are bound by, you know, statute in Oregon law about when they can deny a license. So every year, LaModa gets 7 to 10 new licenses with the Oregon Liquor and Cannabis Commission. So they're growing really quickly.
That's
and the
wild.
OLCC says, you know, there's only a very limited amount of information we can look at when deciding whether or not to grant a new license. It's very much a checkbox thing. You know, that being said, when you look at both ORS and Oregon administrative rules, so OARs are more related to agencies, and then obviously there's state laws, they both have provisions in there about a cannabis company's taxpaying history if they're delinquent on taxes. OAR has, you know, if there's evidence that that the applicant is not financially responsible, that's grounds to deny a license.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a number of provisions in there that would make it seem like the OLCC would be able to deny the license. However, we know that they have never denied a LaModa license, and mm-hmm. so we're still unclear about why exactly that is.
Hmm. Is there a certain number of dispensaries that can open every year? Like a certain number of licenses that get administered every year? Or is it just a free-for-all? I wonder if LaModa being consistently given license after license after license, one of my questions was, are they keeping other potential cannabis companies from getting off the ground? Because they're like snapping up all the licenses before anybody else can.
I don't know. That's a great question, and I really don't know. I know that OLCC processes licenses as they come in, so they say they just have a list.
Mm-hmm.
And they just go down the list. So they, you know, they say that they don't play favorites. so, you know, I don't know if LaModa is crowding out the market. You know, what I can say is that I've talked to, you know, over 30 people in the cannabis industry for this story. And LaModa has, you know, they're a tough competitor because they have really low prices.
Yeah.
So they're tough bargainers. They buy for cheap and they sell for cheap.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of their big things is you can buy a $2 gram at most LaModa dispensaries. And so if there's another shop that doesn't sell a $2 gram, you know, two blocks away, those who are, you know, looking to, you know, not spend whatever it is on a gram at the other store, they're going to go to LaModa. And so I think there's a lot of sentiment in the cannabis industry that LaModa is a really hard bargainer. They make deals. They don't take deals,
mm-hmm.
Especially in a system right now where retailers have the power. Because we have an overproduction of weed again, so we have too much weed in the market, and retailers are obviously the only ones that can actually sell these things to consumers. So everyone along the supply chain is incumbent, you know, they're reliant on the dispensaries to buy their product.
Yeah.
And so oftentimes, if they're really desperate to get rid of their product, they'll be like, okay, take it for whatever you want. And Lamoda can say, great, I'll take it for X amount and then sell it for cheaper.
Yeah.
So I think there is this sentiment that, you know, Lamoda, they sell cheap weed, so people go to them.
Yeah. How did the founders get their start? They weren't legacy market, right?
No, so they, you know, one thing I'll say about Aaron and Rosa is that there's little we can find sort of publicly other than some public records about, you know, what they did prior to this. We know that Aaron, I mean, I guess it technically really is work. He was a professional skateboarder in LA for a couple of years in the early 2000s. Mm-hmm. We also know that kind of from 2005-ish to 2012 or 13, and mostly after the recession, he bought over 20 homes in kind of one of the poorest parts of Daytona Beach. And these were homes where, you know, some of the sewage was flowing into the yard and there weren't appliances and the electricity would go out and windows wouldn't open. So he bought, you know, pretty tough properties and then rented them. And we know, you know, according to public records, and Florida actually has really fantastic public records laws. So they're actually one of the more accessible states in the country, which is kind of amazing. You wouldn't expect that. But according to court records, Aaron and a close associate of his evicted 28 people within a span of 4 years from the homes that he had purchased. It's unclear if he still owns most of those homes or any of those homes. He transferred the ownership to land trusts, and when you're in a land trust, you can't really see the ownership. So it's hard to say if he still owns those properties or not. But, you know, we do know that he kind of capitalized on, you know, after the recession, and he was buying some of those properties for as low as 10 or 15K a piece.
Wow.
So then they, and I have no, you know, it's been really tough to figure out what Rosa was doing before this. I mean, granted, she's young. I mean, she's 34.
Yeah.
And they came to Oregon in 2009. So at that point she would have been 21. So I guess there wasn't that much time to do things, professional things before then. But they came here in 2009, and we know they, you know, at least they've told reporters 5-6 years ago, you know, mostly marijuana reporters, that they came from Florida. So that's what we know.
Has anyone done the math of how much the founders owe their vendors and how much they owe in taxes versus how much they've donated to political candidates and spent on fancy fundraisers?
Yeah, we did our best to do that. I mean, the thing about the lawsuits is that these are all allegations at this point.
Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of people allege that they didn't spend money. But, you know, some of those have settled. Some of those are still ongoing. And, you know, the tax liens, we know what they were when they were issued, and we know a minimum of how much they've paid back, and they've paid back a little over $100,000 of the marijuana tax, and they owe again over were issued liens totaling $590,000. What the Department of Revenue and the IRS won't say is how much of that tax they've paid back. Like, this has been the biggest headache of this story, has been sifting through these tax liens, and you know, the Department of Revenue won't comment on any specific taxpayer, and so it's been really difficult to, you know, figure out how to compute these things. But anyways, so we don't know how much of that tax they've paid back. We do know they've paid at least $108,000 of the marijuana taxes back. But what we can say is that they've donated over and this is Rosa, Aaron, and Lamoda. They've donated over $220,000 since the end of 2019 to Oregon politicians. That includes, you know, over $70,000 to Tina Kotek. That includes over, you know, not over $45,000 to Shamia Fagan, who's the Secretary of State. That includes former Boley Commissioner Val Hoyle, who's now a congresswoman, and sort of a hodgepodge of other legislators and, you know, aspiring politicians, many of whom actually ended up in office. I think all of them ended up in office.
Yeah.
So we know they've spent a lot of money on politics. And the one thing we can say about their bills is that, you know, they've purchased a whole lot of property across Oregon. They own over 30, they own, or LLCs that they control. We have to be careful about the language here, but they own over 30 properties across the state. And we know that since 2017, Aaron Mitchell spent $3.7 million buying properties in Portland alone.
Cazares has some pretty obvious political aspirations. Do you think that she's going to proceed with those political aspirations? Like, she has mentioned, like, potentially running for office. Is that correct?
She's told quite a few people that she wants to run for governor of Oregon specifically. Oh, so she wants to run for high office, according to people that I spoke with. I don't know if she's going to continue to do that. I mean, her political involvement has been really prominent the past 3 years. I mean, they went from having not donated a cent prior to December 2019 to now, you know, having donated over 200,000, they're dining with these people. I mean, they were renting a beautiful $5 million home in the West Hills. They held fundraisers for Tina Kotek. They held a fundraiser for Jessica Peterson. They held, you know, two fundraisers for Shamia Fagan. She's also the vice chair of Emerge Oregon, which is a complete powerhouse of a training academy for women who are aspiring politicians. I mean, mm-hmm. the laundry list of graduates that they have is just incredibly impressive. And so, you know, she's made it into the upper echelon of political involvement. Like, her people know her.
Yeah.
As to whether she'll continue to pursue this, I really don't know.
Is it just very delineated? Like, there's the reputation that Cazares has in the cannabis community and then a reputation that she has in the political community, and those don't seem to be crossing over?
You know, I will say Rosa and Aaron 100% have a reputation in the cannabis industry.
Oh, they have to, yeah.
And, right, and it's not a good one, according to the people I talk to. In the political arena, you know, the people I spoke to, I don't think, at least they said they didn't know. You know, they didn't know about the tax liens. They didn't know about the lawsuit. So, and maybe they didn't. You know, I don't know. I can't say whether they're being dishonest. You know, I don't have any reason to believe they're being dishonest. But from what it sounds like, perhaps it was divorced. But you also have to think that, like, word gets around, you know, gossip. That's what we do. And it would be really amazing to me if there was just a complete, like, bifurcation of their reputation in the cannabis industry and their kind of political dealings.
Totally. Did you talk with any current or former employees?
Yes, I talked to over 10 former employees. And, you know, most of that got cut out in the final story. You know, the focus more became the financial part. But I will say Lamoda entities, there have been 20 former employees who have filed complaints with the Bureau of Labor and Industry.
Oh, shit.
Against Lamoda. And they allege a number of things. And I will say, like, big companies, you're going to get employee complaints. I mean, that is just part of it. So I don't think necessary. I mean, 20 sounds like a lot, but I actually don't know if that's a huge anomaly. But, I mean, one interesting kind of thread that I saw throughout some of those bully complaints is that when, you know, dispensaries have been the targets of armed robberies. And that was a huge deal in 2020. It was kind of a big deal in 2021. And then apparently, and I didn't know this, but it's continued into 2022. So we know that in the fall of 2022, 3 Portland Lamoda dispensaries were robbed. At gunpoint.
Oh.
And so there were a number of complaints saying that essentially Lamoda, you know, didn't take these robberies seriously. They didn't install any safety mechanisms that other dispensaries installed. So, former employees that I spoke to, at least, were not, you know, they did not reflect well on their time at Lamoda.
Thanks to this week's guest, Sophie Peel, and thank you for joining me. I hope you'll join me again in 2 weeks. Till then, bye!